Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Paul Collins is our guest. He was a guest here February 2013, and I didn't have a chance to listen to the archive of that interview. Usually I try to do that, or at least kind of, you know, skip through them before I do a second interview, because I don't want to be too redundant. I didn't have a chance to do that, just been crazy with a million things going on this couple weeks here. Long story, not for podcast audiences. So anyways, I'm apologizing if there's a little bit of redundancy here, but he's a real chatty, talkative guy. 50 years making music since he was a teenager, and not short on opinions or words, so I think you'll find this interesting. I want to say thanks to everybody who contributed to WFMU's recent fundraiser, and you can find information about the archives of this program at wfmu.org/Michael. You can find information about Paul Collins over at thepaulcollinsbeat.com. That's it. Hope you enjoy this. Me and Paul Collins. All right, there is Paul Collins' Stand Back and Take a Good Look. That's the title song from the new album. Paul Collins, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Michael, and it's good to be here.
I know that you do have some sort of New Jersey roots, but I'm a little confused. I see that you were born in Manhattan. You lived in Greece, Vietnam, and around Europe. What was your dad doing that made you move around so much?
Well, I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
It's a juicy story. My father came home one day and said to my mother, I want you to meet my new friend, Bill. You're going to love him. And she did. And my mother and Bill was, Bill and my father worked together, my father Charles, and moving and storage stuff. And when that happened, my mother, this is like 1963, said, I want to go as far away from Douglaston, Queens, I guess, as is humanly possible. And that was Vietnam. And the reason why is Saigon was because any farther, and we would be coming back. I'm not kidding. That's what my mother said. We're going to go as far as we can. Now, bear in mind, she's Italian Catholic. My father's family is Irish Catholic. All that stuff going on. So she just wanted to get out of Dodge. So my stepfather became a civilian in the service. He was an engineer, and he worked with training Vietnamese men how to unload heavy-duty cargo ships. So we went to Saigon. And then on the way back home, because we were there like in 62, 63, I think. And then there was an order for all civilians to come back home because it was getting too dangerous. So on our way back to Long Island, our plane had to stop over in Athens, Greece. And my mother stuck her head out, took a look around and said, we're staying here. So we stayed in Greece for 4 years.
She must have been some kind of lady. That's amazing.
She was.
Yeah.
Yeah, she really was. She was an artist, and she was fortunate enough to be an artist her whole life. And she didn't have a lot of money, but her father taught her how to manage money and left her money in a way that she was able to be independent at a time when most women weren't able to. So she kind of wrote her own ticket, and she took us all over the world, and she loved to travel. You know, for her, life was art. So everything was art. Everything was beautiful. Everything was, you know, having fun and doing, you know, crazy stuff, which I had no problem with at all. And then we finally wound up back here. And the Jersey part is I lived in Leonia for quite a while. That's where I graduated school. And so that was the Jersey connection.
Gotcha. Some kids kind of need a feeling of home or a feeling of things staying the same or some, you know, you were okay with that a little more out there lifestyle?
Well, in the beginning, you know, I never looked back kind of thing. You know, I thought everything was fantastic. I mean, everything was, I mean, insane to go from Manhasset, Long Island to Saigon. It's like,
yeah.
Wow. So I was so, you know, taken up. Now, do you have siblings?
Yeah.
Well, you know how you can talk about an event that happened when you were young, and depending on how many siblings you have, depends on how many different takes there is on the same event.
Sure.
Well, that, you know, all of my family did not share what I felt. And I really had the time of my life, and my mom took us all over the place, and I thought it was great. Eventually, I'm sure my ex-wives and girlfriends will tell you what that manifested into. You know, I'm a real routine guy now. I love my routine. You know, I don't like things to change. You know, I even like, you know, how like with your computer, like every X amount of time, they they changed where everything is, and I'm going, whoa, I was very happy with the, you know what I mean? Or when you redo your phone and then all of a sudden nothing is works the way it used to. I like that kind of stuff. But I guess that might be an offshoot of always traveling.
Fascinating. So eventually you land at Juilliard Music School, and I read that you were studying avant-garde music. Where did that idea come from?
Well, you know, there's a lot of key moments in my life that my mother had a lot to do with, and that was one of them. I'm in Leonia, you know, having breakfast. I don't know, it was probably 10th grade, maybe 11th grade. And my mother comes in and goes, "Get dressed. We're going into New York. It's the last day of auditions at Juilliard." I go, "Mom, what are you crazy? I don't even know how to read music. What are you talking about?" And what had happened is my mother was a very talented artist, and she, at that point in her career, was doing these abstract paintings. And we did a project together called The Elements, and she took oil paints and painted directly on transparent slides. So you can imagine, you put that in the slide carousel and blow it up on the screen, and it's like, wow, you know, it's just all this crazy stuff. And I made a tape. I had coincidentally started my first band called Homegrown. And these guys show up at my house, and we bring in ARP synthesizers and a PA. And I had a tape deck, and we had keyboards, and we had all this stuff. So when they weren't playing rock and roll, I would sit down there and experiment making these tapes with tape speeds and flutes and pianos and the synthesizer. And I made this really, really trippy avant-garde tape. So she said, "Just take that tape and we're going in." So I did. And it's really crazy because Juilliard is a very, very difficult school to get into. And most kids will audition at whatever, you know, piano, whatever instrument they play, and wait a year to find out if they've been accepted. But I go in and I go, "I want to apply to Juilliard." And they go, "Well, what's your major?" And I go, "Composition." And, you know, that's like, composition, okay, go over to the head of the composition department's house, which is four blocks away, play him your tape and see what he says. And I did that, and the guy said, "I'll take him as a student," and I'm in.
Crazy. Okay. Well, I'm going to guess that you did not finish Juilliard because...
I did 1 year.
So why not stay there? You just not for you?
Well, what happened was, so I'm in Juilliard, and also this is like 1973. I really want to play rock and roll. Hmm. There is very, very next to nothing rock and roll going on in New York of the kind of like young people playing. You know, it's all jazz fusion and this, that, and the other thing. And I would try to get things going in Juilliard. There's a whole floor of piano, so I would get these jam sessions going with all these musicians. And of course, the hall monitor would come in and start screaming, you know, "This is not music, stop playing." You know, we're blues or rock and roll or whatever we're trying to do. And I was taking drum lessons. And my drum teacher, the very well-known, may he rest in peace, Sam Milano. Anyway, he says to me, "You got to go out to California, man, if you want to play in rock and roll, if you want to get in rock and roll." So that's what I did.
So eventually, after all this moving around, I think you settled in the Bay Area. And like I said, 50 years ago, started the Nerves. You were a singing drummer, and it's so interesting. Three guys, all songwriters. You do play a little bit of drums, I think, on the new record. But do you miss playing drums? I mean, that's just, you know, it's such a different physical thing than guitar.
I don't miss playing drums. I like playing drums. You know, let's face it, and I think most drummers will agree with me on this. Drums are a tough one, you know what I mean? It's like, they're not very portable. They make a lot of noise. And it's not like you can just wake up in the morning and smoke a joint and start strumming your guitar. You know what I mean? So I did two tracks on this album. And I will say, I have a certain style. If I had to do it over again, I would have practiced a hell of a lot more. You know, because drums, you got to be in shape for drums.
It's very interesting. There's a video, you won't be happy, of the Nerves in 1976. You can find it on YouTube pretty easily. And you're playing the drums and singing, and it's just great to watch. You don't see bands, you know, with that sort of setup too often. Also, you guys are wearing these amazing suits. Tell me about the suits.
Well, you know, that's the only live footage that exists of the Nerves. And I had actually had that tape. There's 13 songs. It's debatable what's going to happen with it because, you know, Jack's daughter and Peter and everybody have to agree on what to do. But so I saw it maybe 40 some odd years later Now, I saw it as being one of the persons who did it. So, you know, it's like me playing you something like something you did when you were 18 in your mind. Now, you know, you have that recollection of it. And it's, you know, tempered with the 30 or 40 years that have gone by. And then if I were to play it for you, like, this is actually what it is, and you go, oh, my God, that's what it was. And for me, it was like that because I had this idea of how good the nerves were and what the nerves did because I did it. But then seeing it on a video, in a pretty good definition video of what we did, I was even more, I don't know, that band was fantastic. It was just everything about it was fantastic. Yeah. And I don't say that because I was in it. I mean, almost it's sad for me because it's a Jesus Christ. I mean, I've been in business now for 15 years and this band couldn't get it out there. Are you serious? This band couldn't get real gigs. And it's such a marvel of compact arranging and just every sparseness and everything about it is so well, the construction and everything. I mean, it's like, it's a 6-piece band really. Because you got the three vocals and the three instruments.
I mean, I agree. Absolutely earth-shaking band, packed with talent and great ideas. Maybe ahead of their time is sort of all I can say. You guys did put out a 4-song EP. I'm curious about how many copies did it sell and how did you sell them?
You know, we pressed up, I think, 2,000. I think Greg Shaw pressed up another 1,000. And there's bootlegs that were put out. And then there's, you know, a couple of repressings and this, that, and the other thing. But I would imagine there can't be any more than 3,000 actual vintage copies from back in 1974 or 5 or 6, whenever we put it out, 76?
76.
I don't think there's more than 3,000 names.
Of the, so, which is actually quite a lot if you don't have a huge record company behind you. So I get from what you're saying that you did have expectations that, like, okay, we're so good, we will catch on and, you know, become rock stars. I mean, was it? And then
no, it was more like we got a bank loan, we got $2,000. I remember we pressed it up at this record plant called Waco. I think no, or maybe it was in Waco. And that was like a deal, you know, you could get 2,000 copies for whatever. And I said, okay. I mean, obviously, we were extremely optimistic. We didn't think that the band was going to fall apart. We thought that, you know, yeah, we should be able to. We actually, what we thought was, and this was Jack's idea, was we put an ad in Rolling Stone and under Rock Collectors. And we thought, you know, we'll sell a ton of these on mail. I mean, they were $2 or something like that. And then we thought, obviously, we would tour, and I don't know, you know. And then I just remember us sitting in the basement at Folsom Street with all these records, stuffing them into sleeves and putting them in mailers and going, Jesus Christ, are we ever going to get rid of this stuff?
So when does the band end, the nerves because expectations weren't met, or frustration, or three guys all writing songs pulling musically in different ways? Maybe you want to get out from behind the exhausting drums, or was it sort of just combo platter, all of the above?
I think the major part of it was we had done everything humanly possible that three people could do, and we could not get any real professional or business reaction. We did the record. We moved from San Francisco to L.A. We did the Hollywood Punk Palace. We toured the United States, round trip. We played with the Ramones. We did all this stuff, and we couldn't get anywhere. And we were flat broke, just as we were when we started. And I think Jack just kind of, and he was the oldest one, I think he just kind of like walked off. Then when obviously the hanging on the telephone thing happened, which was shortly thereafter, I think he just jumped into this world and he's like, you know, I don't need to scrounge around with these guys playing gigs for $5.
In the back of a van, yeah. Okay, that makes perfect sense. So you and Peter stayed together, started the Breakaways, and then eventually you start your own thing, the Beat, the Paul Collins Beat, the Paul Collins Band, you're making solo albums, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you've had this incredible 50-year career. The first Beat album, to me, classic album. If someone were to ask me what is power pop music, I point them to that music. I say, just listen to that. Produced by Bruce Botnick, who'd worked with, you know, he'd worked on Pet Sounds. He'd worked on Love's Forever Changes, worked with The Doors. Was he happy to be, because that is a famously fast recorded album. Was he happy to work that way?
That's like a recipe, you know what I mean? Like if somebody makes a really fantastic cake or dinner or dish or whatever, and all the recipes are the exact, are precisely right and of the highest quality. And Bruce knew what it was in us that was special. And he knew that the best way to do it was to be what in a very traditional sense, he acted as a piece of glass. You weren't supposed to see him or hear him. He was just bringing it to the world and making sure it was as perfect as it could possibly be. And it is. And this is in a time where, you know, David Foster and people like that and Thomas Baker were, it was a producer's medium. Yeah, you got to get that. So you got to get that RTD sound. You got to get that fuck. You know what I mean? And thank God, had we gone with a producer like that, I don't think anybody, they might still say it was great songs, but I don't think they would talk about it as lovingly as people do. And the fact that what you said about, you know, this is what, that's, I mean, you know, obviously, that's a huge feather in my cap. I'm very proud of that record. And I'm almost like, I can't believe that I had the good fortune to make that record as my first record, knowing all the crap that happens, you know, that we didn't, you know, the mistakes that we didn't make and the things that could have gone wrong that didn't, and that how everything went right.
Yeah. So when, just to make it clear, when you were planning to make that record, was there an idea of, hey, maybe we need a producer like Roy Thomas Baker, who's going to take 4 hours to get the snare drum sound every day or whatever? Was that one of the ideas?
No. You know, pretty much my life has been like, you know, that's the only game in town. First of all, the sequence of that was the Nerves. The Nerves are in San Francisco. We can't get a gig anywhere. I'm the guy who books the gigs. Every Sunday I see in the Chronicle, the pink section, Eddie Money at the Long Ranch. Eddie Money here. Mainly at the Long Ranch. Eddie Money at the Long Ranch. Eddie Money. I go, I'm going to get in touch with this Eddie Money and see if we can get a gig. And I go and I call him up. I track him down somehow. He's in Oakland. He says, yeah, come on over. And then all of a sudden, I'm a New Yorker. He's a New Yorker. And bam, he takes me under his arm. He says, I'm going to help you out, bro. And I played him the 45. He goes, these are great songs. And he tried to help the Nerves. We did gigs with them. The last gig we did with Eddie Money, the club owner threw us out of the club and made us wait in the parking lot. He said, I don't even want them coming into the club. A few years go by. I'm in L.A. where we're the Beat is rehearsing at the Mask Club, which was a rehearsal hall by day. And I go out to get some cigarettes and beer, and it's around the corner from a Peaches record store, and there's Eddie Money doing an in-store for Baby Hold On to Me. And I'm like, wow, that's my friend Eddie Money. And I followed him, and I said, I'm never going to see that guy again. He's got a top 10 hit, you know, what's he going to, you know, probably won't even remember me. And he sees me, and he goes, Paulie, how you doing, man? Listen, hang out, wait till I'm done. We'll go smoke a joint. He comes over to my house. We write Let Me Into Your Life. And from that day, and we played for Al Teller, president of CBS Records, on the phone on a Saturday. I'm like dying. You know, you got to understand at that point in time, there was only one thing. Get a record deal. And there was no indie deals. Get a record deal meant get a major record deal and get a hit and get on with life. Mm. So for a year solid, he tells anybody who's willing to listen how great a songwriter I am. I mean, he really does. I mean, and this is at a time when, and he would invite me to parties, and these guys would be sitting around and literally playing $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 demos. People would spend that kind of money on a demo. Best studio in town, best musician. Oh yeah, I got Steve Lukather, I got Chip Rickards playing drums. He's the singer. We cut it at the power station or at the record plant. Anyway. And then he'll pop on a cassette that I made in my living room. Let Me Into Your Life, which sounds like, you know. So finally, Bruce goes, okay, Eddie, let's go check these guys out. So Bruce brings Al Teller to come and see us play, rehearse in the Mask. We play for literally like maybe 25 to 30 minutes. And Al Teller goes to Botnick, sign him, and leaves. And it was everything was left in Bruce's hands. And Bruce, we were like children for him. We were his kids, and he was going to take care of us.
Tell me about being in the Beat and being opening band, because part of being on Columbia is, you, like you said, you know, major label. You get a lot of access you didn't have when, you know, a year earlier when you were nobody, right? So tell me about being the opening band. Well, you know, what are the high and lows of that?
Well, the high is you learn the business. And I had no ego problem opening up for these people because basically we were lucky just to be fucking doing anything. So that part was great. We had great gear. We had, you know, we were not humping it. We had a road crew. We had, I mean, it was like the most luxurious opening act status you could possibly ask for, managed by Bill Graham. And the bad point was opening for, this was also the era where headliners would do everything they could to sabotage opening acts. Anything from taking bandwidth out of the PA so they can't sound good, not letting them adjust the monitors, giving them no room on stage. It was very juvenile and it was very stupid and it was so egotistical, but it was. And so that part of it was crappy. But we also worked, we were in the Bay Area and we were managed by Bill Graham. So we did a ton of great shows. We opened up for Eddie, who was, you know, he was kind of like her godfather. So that was always great. We played with Huey Lewis. We played with Greg Kinn. And all those guys treated us great. And it was a lot of fun working for them. And we became the band that promoters would put on to sell out the show. So we weren't just an opening band. We were the opening band. And that was a great spot. And you're done by 9 o'clock. I mean, what, you know what I mean? You can spend the rest of the night chasing girls.
So that's your upside. I noticed that you had a song on the Caddyshack soundtrack. That is, I assume that's a huge seller. I remember that Kenny Loggins song being everywhere. Does, you know, when you're on a major label, sometimes the accounting, you know, gets this sort of avalanche of charges against you, right? All those guys helping you on tour is something that you eventually pay for or don't. So do you ever see any money from a project like that that still probably sells today? You know, that movie's probably on cable 50 times a day.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up, because when we got dropped from Columbia, CBS, we were unrecouped. So what that meant was, as a writer, I'm with BMI and BMG. So I get certain parts of my royalties, like airplanes, stuff like that. But anything physical related to the record goes to Sony to against, you know, recoupment. And then now, I don't know if you read about this, but there's been a number of lawsuits against majors to get the rights back for the artists of their recordings.
Yeah.
Well, they just settled the Sony one. And it was a class action suit that I was named along with Southside Johnny and David Johansen, only because they needed three musicians in the New York area because Sony's headquarters is in New York. So we were named as the plaintiffs, and they took Sony to court, and they went on and on, and then they went into negotiations for a couple of years, and they just finally publicly announced that it's been settled. And as far as I know, the settlement is that Sony is not going to give the rights back, but they will wipe the slate clean for recoupment. Now, for me, it doesn't really mean much, but for somebody who owes them $11 million and is still a viable artist, or, you know, gets a lot of airplay or streaming is what it's all about. That will mean something. So sometime in the future, I will get any of the streaming revenue from that stuff. But fortunately, I don't know if that'll make any big difference to me, but I do get enough publishing money from all the stuff together that it works out. Okay.
That's curious. I'll be real curious to see if that new let's start a fresh approach makes a difference for guys like you. How interesting. You're known for these simple, melodic, catchy songs. And I'm wondering, is there a musical equation, sort of like the Beach Boys sometimes are described as four freshmen plus Chuck Berry equals Beach Boys. Is there like an equation for what you do?
Yeah. A guy who loves and adores this kind of music and doesn't know what he's doing. I don't have a formula, and it sometimes it drives me crazy. And sometimes it's my only saving grace.
So you just pick up the guitar and these songs pop out?
They don't necessarily pop out. Once in a while, if you're really lucky, like I Don't Fit In popped out. Different Kind of Girl kind of popped out. But then there was a serious year of trying to arrange it. Rock and Roll Girl kind of popped out. a lot of these songs are, it's almost like a puzzle. You get a couple of pieces. And sometimes when I'm writing, if I get a really good piece, I'll stop and I'll say, okay, I'm just going to let this sit. I'll come back to it later. Because my recorder is my mind. I figure if I can't remember it, it can't be any good. So most of these things are done from memory. You know, it's a lot of effort. I mean, it shouldn't be, but it is. You know, I even impressed or surprised myself that I've been able to write as many songs as I have around basically the same six chords. You know what I mean? D-A-D. I was like, wow.
When you sort of allude to you having some unhappy times, are those a direct result of unhappy, unfulfilled expectations about music, or are we talking about a whole other thing?
I've been driven to do this music thing my whole life. And there's a plus and a minus to that. The minus is you can kind of get really single track, one track mind, you know what I mean? And you give up a lot of maybe, you know, you don't smell the roses, you don't do wonderful things that you could have done had you not been so obsessed with doing this one particular thing. I mean, a lot of people that started when I started at a certain point, they said, okay, that's enough. And they, you know, they got really good jobs and they have houses and whatever. So it's really influenced my whole life. It really has. And when you do this kind of music, you really have to have 10 feet thick skin, because there's so much, you know, you have to shoulder so much disappointment and so much, I don't know, humiliation or whatever. You know, it hurts. You know what I mean? It's just when it's that personal, when you write and sing your own stuff, it's very personal. That's why sometimes taking a break from it, which I did when I moved to Spain and I opened up a bar, it was such a relief not to even try to be accepted musically. You know, it's almost like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, the new album is called Stand Back and Take a Good Look. I want to hear this song called I'm the Only One. Dwight Twilley sings on this. Did he cross paths with you back in the olden days?
We crossed paths once. We did a show together. Remember that show at the Bell House? That's when I actually physically met him. I knew of him. And then a funny thing happened was when I did the Kings of Power Pop, when I chose that as I had the song, and the reason why I called the album that was because I had the song. I would have never done that if I didn't have the song. And I was like talking to the label. I was with the Live Records at the time. And I said, you know, I don't know, man, it's pretty pretentious, don't you think? And they go, oh man, you know, sometimes to be in rock and roll, you got to have balls, no problem. So I said, okay, fine, I'll do it. And the other reason was, well, one was that I had the song. And the other reason was most of the people that plied this kind of stuff, my contemporaries, were either dead, like Doug Feiger, or they didn't do it anymore, like Peter Case or a lot of these guys. They were doing other stuff. They were not going out and playing power pop. So I said, you know, the field's pretty clear. Might as well just go for it. And the other thing is, and you probably know this, like if you write a bio for yourself, that's pretty much what you're going to see in all the articles. So might as well make yourself look great, because they just cut and paste it. And it's really true, you know. So I figured, okay, I'll call myself the King of Power Pop. Maybe people believe it and I'll do something good for my career. And the label supported it. And I didn't really get too much. I don't think I got any bad rap for it. But one day the phone rings and it's Dwight Twilley. And I go, oh, I forgot about Dwight Twilley, who is the god of power pop in my book. And before he even has a chance, I apologize to Dwight Twilley. Before he even has a chance to say anything, I didn't mean to offend you. I'm really sorry. I was just kidding around. He goes, oh, don't worry about it, Paulie. He says, you can be the king of power pop. I'll be the king of power poop. So we have had a phone friendship, and they talked to me. I became a go-to guy for a number of people in the business. They saw how much I was touring the States, Canada, Europe, Japan, China. They would call me and say, you know, we want to go to Europe too. What's the deal? So I would be kind of like a resource center. And so then, you know, obviously, there's two separate things. Yes, I'm very proud that Dwight sang on my song. And I love the fact that, and I did not, obviously, it's bittersweet because it is actually the last thing he did. So it's very special. And that is more special to me than the song.
Timing-wise, that's kind of what I was guessing it was. Once again, it is from this brand new album called Stand Back and Take a Look. And folks can get info at thepaulcollinsbeat.com. And I guess you'll be adding tour dates there as they come up. Good luck with this. I'm glad you're still at it 50 years later. It's mind-boggling, really.
Yeah. It's for me, too. You know, and because the thing that always comes to my mind is that Elvis Presley quote, you know, pop music changes every 6 months. And yes, too, the funny thing is now, sitting here, we have the Stones and Paul McCartney. We have all these guys that are older. I said, yeah, well, we're still doing it. So it's kind of like, but yeah, I mean, in generally speaking, it is a younger, well, you can't say younger man's game, younger person's game. But yeah. Fortunately, you know, my world is so far out of the limelight that we can do whatever we want. And the fans, thank God for the fans. You know, it is a very strong, faithful niche market. And it's enough of a market to keep us going.
All right. Let's hear from the new album. And thank you, Paul Collins.
Thank you very much.
That it's real. And when you told me